We have with us this morning a real wonderful person. I think we are so fortunate and so delighted to have with us as our guest speaker, the editor of our forum. She has been a dedicated Al-Anon for 20 years. Her editorials and her new book, Al-Anon's Favorite Forum Editorials, have been an inspiration not only to me, but to all Al-Anons all over the world. It gives me great pleasure to introduce to you at this time Margaret Dean from our World Service Office in New York. Margaret.
Thank you, Ferris. There's one thing I've really learned in Al-Anon. Thanks. And that is that you should shut your ears to the introductions or you'll really begin to believe you're somebody. Because Al-Anons and AAs, I have found, are the most generous people in the world. So that I hope you continue that generosity. If I say something stupid, it's not meant to offend anybody. I didn't come down here to make bad friends. And before I begin talking about Al-Anon, please let me thank you for inviting me. I've loved it. I can't wait to get home and tell my husband that I'm going to move to Augusta, because last night I slept 5 whole hours at a stretch. And since the middle of July, 2 is the most that I've had ever since my accident. And I'm so grateful and I feel so marvelous now that I may just sort of bust out all over. And I'm sorry if I do that. To begin with, what I say, I do edit the forum, thank heaven. I love that job. I do work at headquarters occasionally. I'm not there all of the time, but I've been on the board of directors sort of ex officio all of the years since I first volunteered. But what I say now is not official. It is simply my own experience and my own observations. And I've got quite a few blind spots I discover as I go along. And I think maybe I've overcome quite a few of them in the Al-Anon program. But they wouldn't be blind spots if I knew what they were. So maybe you'll find one today. There are, I think, quite a few AAs here this morning, and I'm always glad to see them because I'm so grateful to them. They have been so extremely generous with their program. And they must find when they come to Al-Anon meetings that sort of is reminiscent of their own program, because we have taken so much from them and they have given it to us so generously and so gladly. And I do think, without bragging, that we've put it to very good use. Even Bill Wilson is proud of us. So that I'm awfully glad to see you here. There's one thing I should say. That is that some years ago, I've forgotten now, 6, 8, 9, I was invited to go up to Prince Edward's Island to speak at a conference or a convention of all the Atlantic provinces. And I was simply scared to death. I'm not afraid, as a rule, to talk to any number of AAs or Al-Anon. I figure they're my own people. And if I can talk to one, I can talk to 1,000. But here these people were. They were Canadians. And they were on that island out in the Atlantic. I was from Chicago, the breezy Midwest. And were they going to think that I wasn't serious? Were they going to think that I was completely different? And I just really didn't quite know how I was going to do. Well, I worked like a dog on my talk. I thought, I'm going to have every single line of this as pure Al-Anon as I'm able to make it. And I never read talks. I think that's quite bad. I do take notes, and I do have it in front of me in case I might hit a blank spot. But up there, I had worked so hard, and the audience, it was a delightful audience, and it seemed very responsive. And when I got done, I don't think anybody ever says everything that he means to say or says it the most perfectly, but I thought, well, old girl, you didn't do badly. I'm not sorry you came up here. I think maybe it was all right. So a day later, I met a man in the lobby. I didn't have a name tag on. I didn't have anything. And he looked at me and he said, you talked Saturday, didn't you? And I said, yes, I did. And he said, well, you know, I sat there with the tears streaming down my face most of the time you were talking. And I looked at him, and of course my face fell. And I said, golly, I worked on that talk, and I thought I put quite a bit into it. I didn't realize it was that bad. And he said, oh, no, it wasn't that. He said, I haven't cried in 20 years. But he said, for the first time, I realized how my drinking had affected anyone else. And I looked at him and I said, I should have stayed home in New York. The whole point that I thought I was making was that what happened to me was my own stupid fault. It was not the fault of my husband's drinking. Alcoholics carry enough of an intolerable burden of guilt so that I wouldn't add one feather to it. I was responsible in that I was ignorant. I didn't know, in spite of having a father for a doctor, I did not know the word alcoholism when I got married. I had never met it in my home, although I was brought up in the sort of family that always had cocktails before dinner. If the family played cards after dinner, there were highballs and that sort of thing. I never saw anybody affected in the least until I was grown up and my own friends drank too much. But from the time I was born, the dining room sideboard had two decanters on it. One of them was whiskey and the other was brandy. And so what? They meant nothing to me. And after I was married, I suddenly found that my husband's drinking was very different from mine. I loved drinking. I still do. When the hostess on the plane came around yesterday, and said, would I like something to drink? I looked at her. I said, I'd like 6 drinks, but I don't dare take a drop. because with this blasted arm of mine, I'm taking some sort of medicine and I'd be scared to death to mix them. But for a while, I couldn't even think of liquor without my stomach just turning over, because I found immediately after we were married that Jack's drinking was entirely different from mine. I could take it or I could leave it alone. And he couldn't do either one, the poor thing. And I had no understanding of it. I had no sympathy for it. And I would look at him, one of those compassionate wives, and say, "Well, you did this, suffer." And I just thought that was the answer to everything. All my life, if I had done something, if I had eaten something that I knew I shouldn't and it made me sick, I thought, well, be sick. You earned it. And I had the same attitude about liquor. Utterly no comprehension until AA came that it was a compulsion and that it was a disease. So that, as I say, what did happen to me came through ignorance. I believe we were married something like 15 years before things came to a crisis. And I was, by that time, we had lived the first 3 years of our marriage in Paris, and I was delighted to come back home to this country, because in Paris there are 49 bistros to every block. I think there are more of them than there are dogs, and there are more dogs than there are people. So that I thought, if we'd ever get back to this country, especially out to the ranch in Montana, where I had spent 4 summers as a guest, we were invited to go out there and run it. I thought, boy, that will be the thing. It's 80 miles to town and a bar or a liquor store. So I, fortunately, Jack sparked the idea immediately, and I promoted it. To begin with, our daughter was 19 months old, and she was speaking French instead of English, and I didn't like that. And also, the great geographic cure, I thought, would solve all our problems. Out there in those Rocky Mountains, it would be easy to keep liquor away from Jack. And by then, while I still didn't understand that it was a compulsion, I did know that if he once began drinking, he couldn't stop. I almost became an alcoholic with him, because I figured that what I drank, he couldn't. So when I can't bear to have anything cloud my thinking, and when I found that about 7 drinks did, I'd think, well, nuts. And in spite of Scott's blood, I'd start pouring liquor out. But you all know how successful any of those things are. And the ranch idea was just about as successful. Well, then the war came, and Jack re-enlisted and was over in China. Then he came back, and he was in, I guess it's Fort Dix. He was in both wars. One time it was a camp, the other time it's a fort. But he was there, and when he was separated, he was in New York, and he dropped into the New York office of his old agency, and Ben Duffy said, "When are you going to come to work, Jack?" And Jack said, "I didn't come in for a job. I came in to say hello." And he said, "Well, we could use you." So he called me up and said, how would you like to live in New York? Well, that was before the Al-Anon program, and if I had been honest, I would have said I'd hate it. By that time, I figured that any place that had three houses together was a slum, and I didn't want any part of a city as big as New York. But I always figured that a wife should go where a husband wanted to or where he worked. So we moved down. And in the interim, things had got very much more rugged than they had been. Our daughter by that time was older. By this time she was about 9 years old. And I was so thoroughly ashamed of this uncontrolled drinking, not knowing that it was a disease. I just thought that it was a bad temper and self-indulgence and all the other unattractive qualities. And I did my very best to hide it from her so that things really got bad. And one particular morning, I was on my way to church at 6 o'clock in the morning to show you just how screwy a fairly normal person could get. The service began at 6:30 and would be over by 7, and it would take me 10 minutes, maybe 5 minutes, to get home. But I wanted to be sure to be there so that I could keep Jack from running out to a bar. And bars in Yonkers don't open until 1 o'clock on Sunday. But I was going to be there. And I was there. But anyhow, I suppose it was a very bad time with us, because I got to the foot of a hill, and if any of you know Yonkers, you know that it's one hill after another. I got to the bottom of a hill, and I also got to the end of my endurance. And I stood there. It was a beautiful May morning. And fortunately, there was nobody on the street. And I just stopped dead, as if somebody had put a hand on my shoulder. And I looked up, and I just yelled aloud, God, you have got to help me. I cannot go on alone. Well, I'd never done a thing like that in my life before. To begin with, I'd always thought God was a very important person, and you didn't yell at him. And further, he was supposed to know what to do, and it really wasn't up to me to tell him. But by that time, I didn't really much care. And as I heard myself when I said, I cannot go on alone, I thought, well, now you really have cracked. So I went on to church. And by a strange coincidence that morning, they read the epistle. They don't always. They do now, but they didn't used to. And the epistle was on the coming of the Holy Spirit when he descended on the apostles and he enlightened and strengthened them. And it was just as if I had never been in a church in my life before. Because all of my life I had prayed to the Father and the Son. And the Holy Spirit sort of was the little man that wasn't there. I had never really given him any house at all. And suddenly it came to me. And I thought, Margaret, if those apostles needed strengthening and enlightenment. What do you need? There's nobody in this entire country that needs more of it than you do. So I spent the rest of that service, praying to the Holy Spirit to give me enlightenment, that I bitterly needed it and that I wanted it. And on my way home, at the very spot where I had stopped and yelled at God, from out of nowhere, across my mind, came the two letters, AA. Well, this was in 1946, and I don't remember whether Jack Alexander's article was in 40 or 41. It's really not important. But I had read it out on the ranch, and I looked at it, and it talked about alcoholics, and it talked about their erratic behavior and their inability to handle liquor and so on. And I thought, why, Jiminy, they're talking about Jack. This is what's the matter with him. And if I ever get near where they are, I'm going to get in touch with them and find out what to do about it. And in it, he listed the 12 steps, and I read them, and I thought, well, that's a wonderful way of life, but how in the world would it stop anything like this? It sort of sounds like a do-good organization. I wonder if they could help Jack. And so it went out of my mind, and I didn't think of it until that morning. And I am sure it was a direct answer to prayer. And so I went home, happy as a lark. I knew what to do. Well, of course, Jack was having the king of all hangovers. The body was lying in state, and all he wanted, and this was a little after 7 in the morning, and you think he'd be entitled to it, all he wanted was a little peace and quiet. Well, you know what an enthusiastic wife can do. I walked in. Jack, you know your drinking is different from mine. It's not normal. And there are people who know what to do about it. There are people who could help you. And all we have to do is look in the phone book and call them. And he said, what are you talking about? And I said, I'm talking about a thing called AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. I read about it in the Saturday Post while we were still out on the ranch. But these people are experts, and they could help you. Oh, he said, I don't need any help. I could stop any time I wanted. Well, of course, he'd been telling me that for 15 years, and it kind of didn't make the same impression it had once. So I went from bad to worse. And finally, as you would know, I drew myself up, and I had never threatened in my life. I never make scenes. I'm the 4th of 8 children. And if you want to make a scene in a big family, be the first one or the last one. Because the ones in the middle accommodate themselves both ways. So that I wasn't always fussing and whatnot. This was something brand new for me, and believe me, I meant it. And I stood there looking just like Grant Wood's American Gothic. And I said, all right, it is AA or else. And I just stormed out of the room. Well, as I say, this was completely different from anything I ever had done. And Jack recognized it. And he thought it over maybe for a half hour or an hour. And then he called. He said, Marg, call those people. I'll see them. Well, of course, I didn't know a thing about, there wasn't even any Al-Anon. This was 5 years before there was Al-Anon. And so I gladly went to the telephone and got some people. They came over. They were simply stupendous. Two of the nicest men I have ever met in my life. And I went out to the other room so I could leave them alone. And then they came and got me, and they said they thought that perhaps I would be interested, and wouldn't I come in? Well, I thought it was the most terrific program I had ever heard in my life. It suddenly all made sense, and I could see, really, how it would help. And so they took Jack to meetings all over the place, and he adored it. He was enchanted. He's a terrific salesman anyhow, and I think he really could have sold AA to a teetotaler. But after a few weeks, initially he was a little shy, but after a few weeks he said, "Marg, I think you'd enjoy these meetings too. Wouldn't you like to come?" They had closed meetings on Thursday and open meetings on Saturday. He said, "Wouldn't you come with me Saturday night?" And I said, "I'd love it." I walked in to that meeting, and there were about, more than a dozen women. There was one woman who was an AA, but all of the rest were wives of the alcoholics. And I looked around and I thought, well, my heavens, there are other wives like me. It was the first that had ever crossed my mind that I wasn't completely alone with this problem. And I, too, enjoyed the meetings. I listened to the speakers. I was fascinated by them. Sometimes I was horrified because 20-odd years ago, stories were, I think people didn't come to AA quite as early. I think that both of our fellowships are doing a better job of reaching people sooner now. So that these stories were kind of horrifying, many of them. But some way, I was dumb enough and literal enough to say to myself, this is the AA program, which meant that it was for alcoholics. It never once crossed my mind that I could use those steps that I thought were so terrific. And I just went on listening. Believe me, I listened hard, because I was so afraid Jack was going to miss a point. And on the way home, I wanted very subtly, just like a herd of elephants, to call his attention to it. And he never sat near me, I think because he knew that he'd have a sore arm from me kind of nudging him. But one way or another, I would bring up all of the things that I thought would be helpful. I don't blame a lot of AAs who initially distrusted Al-Anons. Their program was such a life-saving thing to them that they didn't want any monkey business about it. And a lot of wives are full of monkey business after they've lived with alcoholics for a certain number of years. I think that not only women, but men, non-alcoholics, are rather devious, and they wish to extend their sphere of influence And I can see where an AA doesn't want any influence. His program is enough for him. So that initially, I think they did distrust us. There are a few places where they still do. But there's one thing. This is, we had the preamble, but this comes from our purpose. It's only part of it. The purposes of Al-Anon are to welcome and give comfort to the families of alcoholics, to give understanding and encouragement to the alcoholic in the home, and to grow spiritually through living the steps of AA. Well, welcome and give comfort to the families of alcoholics. Naturally, if you've benefited by this program, your first wish is to share it with somebody else. To give understanding and encouragement to the alcoholic certainly is any spouse's duty. If a husband or a wife were suffering from cancer or from an ulcer, or even as I am now, from a broken arm, I think any spouse, husband or wife, would do all that he or she could to make life a little better. Do you think I did? Oh, no, not at all. I made things as difficult as I could, not really knowing that I was doing wrong. But we not only are supposed to give understanding and encouragement to the alcoholic, we go a little further and we say, in the home. And by Jiminy, that's important. It wasn't my business in AA meetings to see that Jack understood what was said. No Al-Anon ever should try to 12-step an alcoholic. One alcoholic understands another and can help him. One Al-Anon can understand another and help him or her. But AA is for alcoholics and Al-Anon is for Al-Anons, so that where we do our understanding and comfort is the home. Then, of course, the last one, to grow spiritually through the 12 steps of AA, our steps are exactly the same as AA's, except that we have changed the one word, alcoholics, in the 12th step. You carry the message to alcoholics. And we say, having had a spiritual experience and so on and so on, we carry the message, try to carry the message to others. Well, these things I didn't learn in AA. I learned them and I gave them terrific lip service, how wonderful they are. But I didn't try to live them myself. It just didn't come to me to do it. As a matter of fact, there were three men who came into AA approximately the same time my husband did, and they used to spend a lot of time at our house. And you know, every once in a while, how antsy they would get. It's a very difficult period of adjustment. And they used to walk up and down like crazy cat, just thinking, ooh, if I could only go out and get a drink or something like that. And I had the great temerity to look at them and say, you know, you're lucky. You've got only one problem. If you solve that, if you attain sobriety through AA, you'll have justified your whole existence and you'll go straight to heaven. Well, you know what house I met with. I don't know why they didn't kill me right there. But they didn't. They just sort of looked at me patiently. And it was about 3 or 4 years. I'm one of those quick studies, as they say. After Al-Anon, that I finally figured I too had one problem, and I had done nothing about solving it. My problem wasn't to attain and keep sobriety. Mine was to live with alcoholism, if that was what was to be. And I had done nothing to adjust to it, nothing to help myself overcome this. Well, as I say, 3 or 4 years of Al-Anon taught me. I think I had been going to AA meetings for about 6 years before the woman AA member called me one day, and she said, "Margaret, there's something new. It's for families of alcoholics." And she said, "God knows somebody ought to do something for them. Look at the ones in the wives of our group. They're a worse mess than they were when their husbands became sober." And I looked around and I agreed with her. I knew I was. By that time, I had deteriorated so badly that I wouldn't answer my telephone. I was scared to death that someday the telephone man would come and he'd take it apart and he'd find a half a dozen Kleenexes stuffed in so that it wouldn't ring. I wouldn't answer the doorbell. I might know as well as anything that it was the laundryman, because he used to come at about 7:45 Thursday morning. But do you think I would answer that door? No. I'd have my laundry sitting outside with a little note, "Pay you next time." I don't know what was the matter with me, but I was living in such horrible fear, in such insecurity, that if anybody asked us 2 weeks ahead of time for dinner, I always had an engagement. We were already booked up. You'd think we were popular. And if Jack came home and he had told one of his co-workers that we would go to their house on such and such a day, I'd wait until that morning, and then I would give myself a migraine and get out of it. He could be sober or he could be drinking, and it didn't make one particle of difference. I just could not face seeing people for fear that he would drink. And he was a quiet drunk most of the time. If you'd just let him sleep, he'd get over it. So that why I should have been so embarrassed, heaven only knows. But I was, and I had made myself completely miserable. Well, after this initial great success in AA and enthusiasm, he changed jobs, and it was the most wonderful job he'd ever had. The most money, the most authority, the most everything. And in some distorted way, he was afraid that somebody would learn he was in AA and think maybe he couldn't do the job. So he stopped going to AA meetings. And that's a rather dangerous procedure, I've observed over the years. And he got into difficulties again. And in all that time of my going to these meetings and hearing these stories, I had relaxed so completely. After all, anybody who once knew this program, they could never vary it, never change from it. But then when I found they could, I had more things to worry about. I'd never connected things in the paper with drinking. I'd never even heard of DTs. Blackouts, nobody'd ever mentioned them. And wet brains, I didn't know what they were. And suddenly all these things came to me. And I was a worrywart enough. I had nothing to fight them with. All I had done was praise the program. I had not tried to put it into effect so that I had no ammunition at all with which to fight this appalling load of fear. This job of Jack's had entailed going over to Philadelphia every Wednesday. And he would take a morning train over, and he would do his job and do it beautifully. Then he would leave the others, and he'd think, well, here I am out of town. I'll have a quick one that nobody will know about. Well, what alcoholic ever had a quick one that nobody knew about? They might not have known about the first one, but I don't think they ever really stopped with the first one. So that in some way, Jack would come home Wednesday nights, and he would have been drinking. And as I say, I had relapsed so completely that it was worse. Most relapses, I think, are worse than the original disease or disability, whatever. And in some way, my laundryman, as I told you, came Thursday morning. On Wednesday, I used to change the beds and put it all together so that I could have it out there before he rang the bell. And in some way, Wednesday and picking up the laundry were indelibly welded to the idea that Jack might come home from Philadelphia having started a binge. And you can tell how far I was from normal, from the things I've told you, it's kindergarten stuff about throwing out liquor. I did that by the quart. I took his money and lied to him about it. I hid his clothes. I did everything that I could think of to put impediments in his way. And, of course, you know how effective any of those were. But anyhow, in one way or another, I connected changing Jack's bed with his beginning to drink. Well, I had been raised to use logic. None of us were really stupid, although I acted stupidly for a great number of years. And I was so ashamed of myself that it was an appalling idea to me. I thought, why, that is nothing but ignorant superstition, and you're allowing it to influence your life. But for love or money, I could not change the sheets on Jack's bed unless he was right there in the house. They got horrible. I wouldn't let my daughter in our bedroom until they were well covered up by a spread because I was so ashamed of them. And as I say, all of the time, I had this feeling of guilt and oppression. And that, as much of anything, was on my mind. It almost never left it. Well, it was just at about this stage that Nancy called me and said there was something for the wives of alcoholics. She didn't know what it was, but Lois needed help. She had taken one of the wives of the group up to see Lois because Ruth had gotten such a state. And so she gave me Lois's telephone number, and she said she needs help. Well, one of these four men that I said had only one problem in life, boy, why he didn't kill me, I'll never know. He had been working on a special project with Bill, I think up at Ossining. And after they got through at the prison, they used to go back to the Wilsons and have coffee. And this one time, I don't know what they'd been working at, but whatever it was, Dick said, "You know, Bill is marvelous, but," he said, "sometimes I think that little Lois is smarter than he is." Well, I'd read the big book, I guess by that time, I'd read it a couple of times. I'd bought three of them for my husband. But, well, he always gave them away before he read it to somebody that needed it more than he did. And I didn't think that was possible, so I'd go buy another one. Well, I had been to the birthday dinners. I'd heard Bill speak. And by that time, I thought this was the most terrific program that I had ever heard of. And I thought, boy, if there's anybody smarter than Bill Wilson, I want to lay eyes on her. So it wasn't out of dedication. It wasn't out of anything but sheer curiosity that I had time, and I thought it was a worthy cause. So I did volunteer. Well, that was in March of 1952. They had moved into New York the middle of January because they couldn't get any volunteers up in Westchester. And the work had grown so fast that they needed help. And I went in there thinking that I would stay 3 or 4 months and then I would get a regular job. And I'm still there. And that's what Al-Anon is. It is the way AA is. If you need it, it gets you. And it is so much a part of your life that it really never leaves you. So I went in, and the state that I was in was simply appalling. They asked me what I could do, and I said, "Well, I was a secretary before I was married. I can do anything," which is a masterly overstatement. But anyhow, I could type, I could write letters, and so on. I knew nothing of the program, but they gave me sample paragraphs, and then they would give me these letters from all over the country, people writing in for help. What do I do? How can I help? And so on. And I would walk in. I was polite. I would say good morning. And I would have the letters on this side with my sample paragraphs, and I'd match them up. And I'd finish them, and I'd put them over there. And I would do that from 9:30, whatever time we began, until we stopped at 4. We all brought in sandwiches, and we made coffee. And Lois and Ann and Dot were, the four of us were alone for quite a while before other volunteers. Well, Irma came over in the afternoon. She had a part-time job at the AA intergroup office. But there were those four of us for lunch. And those three used to have really what amounted to an Al-Anon meeting. You never get three Al-Anons together that it doesn't come up some way or another. But I just sat there and ate my sandwich, and I never said a word. And then I would go back and pick up my letters and begin typing again. And they were terribly worried about me. They said, something has got to get to her. Something has to crack that shell. Something is terribly wrong. And I think many times now they've been kind of sorry they cracked it. However, this one day, and I'd been answering these letters for maybe 3 months without any comment at all, never a word out of me. But some woman wrote something, and it got to me. And I whammed the letter down on the desk, and I said, I wish to heaven Christ had never worked that first miracle at Cana. I wish alcohol had never been invented. It is the worst curse there is. And, well, you know, it was just suddenly as if the heavens had opened up. Here was this mute that had been sitting for 3 months. And, you know, Lois, she is the most perceptive person. And her mind goes straight. It's just like an arrow. Straight to the point. And she looked and she said, oh, Margaret, never, never, never think that. And I looked at her and I said, what's worse? And she looked at me and without any hesitation at all, she said, oh, living with a mean-spirited man. And by golly, wasn't she right? I don't think there would be any hell comparable to living with a mean-spirited husband or wife. And that is one thing that I have never found an alcoholic to be. I think they're the most generous people. I think they're over-eager to assume blame and responsibility. I wish that they could shed it. My husband worries me every once in a while when I say, oh, Jack, don't do that. Don't do that. It's too difficult, or it's you haven't time. And he said, Marg, I want to make up to you and to Margie for the things I did. And I looked at him. I said, those are all past, Jack. That's one thing we do. We learn that it's over. And he said, well, I still want to do it. Well, I wish he didn't feel that way. I wish that he could just say, I did it. I can't change it. I'm doing better now. That's fine. But there, I've never known an alcoholic to have any intimation of meanness. And I think perhaps that was the very first light that entered that tightly closed mind of mine. And I began to think that alcoholics weren't all, begins with B. I began to think that they weren't such monsters, that maybe they had some human attributes. And the next step in my regeneration, if I am regenerated, was that we finally made a meeting, an Al-Anon meeting up in Westchester. Lois and Ann, from the very beginning, had invited me to come up. But some way or another, something always happened at the last minute, and we couldn't go. They met at night, and it was, I don't know, 30 miles from Hastings to Bedford Hills, and I couldn't go up alone. And fortunately, it was an open meeting, and there was no AA meeting that night, so that Jack was welcome. But I think I was sitting right tight in God's pocket, that I went to the meeting, the first meeting that I did attend. I'm sure that if I had gone any time during the 3 or 4 previous months when I had aimed at going, that I'd have heard a good Al-Anon meeting. I've seldom heard a bad one. Occasionally there are some that are less interesting. There are some that just rock you back on your heels. But they're never wasted. But this particular meeting, there was a little girl, lovely looking little thing, pretty as a picture, one of those Irish beauties with eyes back about here, a pansy blue and lashes about that long that belonged to her. She was lovely looking. And she stood up there, and in front of 8 or 9 people, she had the courage to stand there and say, "I was a compulsive housekeeper." And she said, "If there was a spot on one of my curtains, I felt that the whole house needed house cleaning. But," she said, "I have learned to live with those curtains a good battleship gray, because every time I washed them, Jim started a binge." Well, those 8 or 9, well, 8 of the 9 people laughed because it sounded so silly. And, of course, it was silly. I didn't. I sat there completely frozen. I thought, my heavens, maybe I'm not on my way to Warm Springs. Maybe I'm not going crazy. If she didn't wash her curtains and I don't change my sheets, look at her now. And she can talk about it in front of all these people. And here I had been so burdened with shame and so oppressed with guilt and superstition and whatnot, that it was just as if something had sort of poleaxed me. I couldn't have moved. And so then she went on and she said, "I finally decided that my husband was a periodic. And I watched, and his period between binges, when he would finish one, there were usually 6 to 7 weeks before he began the next one. And so I thought, well, I'm going to interrupt this jinx. That's all there is to it. If I can stop it from happening one time, I'll be free of it." So she waited until he was drinking. And while he was drinking, she washed her curtains. And when he came off that binge, she figured there are at least 6 weeks now before he'll begin again. I'll wash my curtains this very day. And after that, it'll never happen again. So she washed her curtains. And that night, he was due home at 5:30. That night at about 10 o'clock from somewhere up in Connecticut, she lived in this side of the line in New York, way into Connecticut, he called her, and he had begun another one. Well, I don't know how she got out of that, how she figured that the jinx wasn't broken or whatnot, but anyhow, after that, she did wash her curtains whenever they needed it. And I took one look at her and I thought, well, pretty as you are and attractive as you are, if you can wash your curtains, I can go home and change my sheets. And so the next morning, with the greatest flourish in the world. I whipped those awful sheets off Jack's bed. And from then on, I lived like a human being. Well, that probably was in June or July. And about in August, the Mount Clare group invited three of us from my own group to come over and give them a meeting. Well, I hadn't been in Al-Anon too long, and I hadn't really been practicing the program, really. I would admit to anybody that my life had become unmanageable. All you had to do was give me 30 seconds, and I would tell you that. But it never occurred to me that it was unmanageable because I had never acknowledged that I was powerless over alcohol. In spite of Al-Anon, I was still trying to manage Jack's life. I had bought the idea of the first drink so thoroughly that I bent every effort day and night to keep it from him. I had a parade of doctors that practically met each other when he had had a drink or two drinks. I spent $30 I couldn't afford, the worst $30 I ever spent in my life, to get a hypnotist to come. And he came, complete with his wife in a little portable Victrola in a blue light. Don't ask me what the blue light was for. I still shudder when I see one. But anyhow, he came because somebody had said that a man could be hypnotized into never drinking again. Well, he came, and he had this blue light, and he swung his watch, relax, relax, relax. Well, by the time he got done relaxing, I think I was ready to walk upside down on the ceiling. And you know how much good that did. I had gone to a doctor. Jack had misunderstood something Margie said one night at dinner. And they had the most marvelous relationship. I had tried to hide things from her until I went to AA. But the minute that I heard that it was a disease, intellectually I accepted it. I don't think I did wholeheartedly. But as I learned anything about the program, I went home and taught it to her. And it made sense to her that a thing which would change her father so much must be a disease. So that this time when he misunderstood her and he was a bit fuddled, he lit with both feet for the first time in his life. And she was a very gentle soul. And she didn't say anything at all. She just accepted it. And after she had gone to do her homework, I went into her room and I said, Margie, Daddy never would have spoken as he did if he had understood you. And she looked and she said, why, Mommy, I didn't pay any attention at all. He'd been drinking. And I looked at her and I said, drinking? What difference does that make? He said those things. And she said, oh, when he has been drinking, he's not my father. And I don't pay any attention to him. Well, of course, I was horror-stricken. Drinking or not, after all, she had only one father, and I knew who that was. And so I said, Margie, you can't do a thing like that. No matter what he does, he is your father. Oh, no, Mommy, not when he's drinking. And I said, well, what do you do? Do you turn it on and off like a tap? And she said, why, no, when he's not drinking, he's himself. And he is my father. Well, I just did not understand it. And I was terribly upset by this, and we weren't getting anywhere. And so I called up, we were living in Yonkers at that time, I called up the very busiest doctor, the biggest specialist there was, and said I needed an emergency appointment. And I must have sounded as if I did, because his nurse, usually if you called for an appointment, you got one in 3 weeks. Well, I got one that day. And I went into him, and I looked at him, and I said, Doctor, before you specialized in internal medicine, you were a surgeon, weren't you? And he said, yes. And I said, sometimes bones healed wrong and had to be broken over again. He said, yes, I've done that. And I said, would you break Jack's leg for me, please? Well, he didn't laugh. He looked at me, and he said, what would that do? And I said, well, if I could just keep him from drinking, if I could keep that very first drink away from him, he wouldn't drink the rest of it. And after 2 or 3 weeks, he'd be all right, and he would be back in AA practicing the program. Well, the poor thing, he wanted the program. He would have a slip, but believe me, the next week after this initial period when he was afraid somebody would know that he was in AA, he would be back. Nobody in the world ever tried harder getting the program. And so I said, if I could just keep him from that. And I said, if he had a broken leg, it would be in a cast, and he'd be in bed, and I could keep liquor from him. Well, the doctor was completely horrified, and he looked at me, and he said, what has this done to your daughter? Well, that should have given me a clue. And so I said, oh, doctor, I said, that worries me too. And so I told him about this business of when he's drinking, he's not my father. When he's not drinking, he is. And he looked at me, and he just shook his head in complete amazement. And he said, isn't it wonderful how children find their own protection? And I looked at him in more amazement, and I thought, I have come to a fool. That doesn't make sense. And again, it took years of Al-Anon before I realized that Margie apparently was born knowing the first step. I had a struggle with it, because some way I figured that if I was just a quarter of an inch smarter, I could find the thing that would stop his drinking. It wasn't that I wanted to run our lives. I never did. I never took over our checkbook or anything like that. But boy, did I ever try to stop his drinking. I made hell for him and for me. I did everything that anybody in Al-Anon ever did, and I added some variations. But of course, I didn't have enough sense to realize that what I should do was tend to my own knitting and do nothing. After all, it was the AA program, Jack was the AA. What was I going to Al-Anon for if not to learn how to manage my own life and keep my hands off him. But before I had learned this, it was after 4 or 5, 6 months maybe in Al-Anon, that this Mount Clair group invited us over. And I thought back, and I remembered Lois's with her living with a mean-spirited spouse. And I thought, I can tell them about that. And I can tell them about some of these letters that I answer and what problems other people have and so on. And I thought, one way or another, I could get together a speech that would make sense. But underneath all of it, there was this nagging thought about me and my sheets and Mary and her curtains. And I thought, oh no, I can't say that in public. How could I admit such a shameful thing? And then I'd think, well, she did it. I got over to that Mount Clair meeting, and there weren't 8 or 9 people. There were about 60 of them. And that almost fixed it for me. But they introduced me, and I got up. And as I was walking from there to here, something said to me, Margaret, where would you be if that little girl hadn't told her story? And so I drew a deep breath, and I told them about my filthy sheets. And, of course, they laughed. They thought it was hilarious. But after the meeting was over, one woman came up and she threw her arms around my neck. I'd never seen her before. She said, Margaret, thank God you came here tonight. She said, I'm going home and roast a chicken tomorrow. It was her family's favorite thing, and she hadn't done one in years. She'd given them fried chicken, she'd made chicken salad, she'd made chicken and dumplings, she'd done every other thing in a cookbook. But by golly, when she roasted a chicken, Harry began drinking, so she stopped. She stopped roasting them. Another woman, that same night, there were 4 of them. She came up, she would get out of bed because she had variegated china. And if she had gone to bed with a blue cup on a yellow saucer, George came home. There was a third woman. She wouldn't put a gray tablecloth. It was her favorite. She wouldn't put a gray tablecloth on her table until Herbert walked in the door sober. If he came in at 6 and she put it on at 6:02, he came home drunk. The fourth one, she could cook corned beef and cabbage, which her husband adored, and her family, on Monday night, and that was all right. But let her cook it on Saturday, and it started a binge. Well, I was glad. Each one of them said, if you could change your sheets, I can roast my chicken, and so on, just as I had said. If that girl could wash her curtains, I could change my sheets. I was glad that I had told it. And I have never told it since that I haven't found at least 1 or 2 that has been carrying that same burden of superstition and guilt. And in case any of you AAs out there are feeling a little smug about how dumb these Al-Anons are, down in Hollywood, California, an AA man told me he was going home and put on a blue suit for the first time in I don't know how long, because for a couple of years, every time he had put that suit on, he had begun to drink. An AA woman at the same meeting said, if I am going to clean house, I always begin upstairs, because if I begin in the living room, pardon me, I start a binge. But she said, after this, I'm going to begin where it needs it most. So I guess maybe all of us are human. And it's not just Al-Anons that are so stupid. Well, as I say, I kept on making all of these mistakes. All of them violating that first step. I would work on it. My group told me that I had never taken it. Dot, this friend that spoke with me that time in Montclair, we had a gentleman's agreement that we could take each other's inventory. And you know, if you really and truly trust the other person, that's a pretty good idea. Because she would tell me things and I'd say, well, you must be crazy. Of course that isn't so. And then I'd think it over in 5 minutes and I'd say, Dad, I think you're right, maybe. And she would do the same, because you're much more ruthless with another person. Maybe you don't, but I sort of tend to give myself a break. I think, well, maybe I wouldn't have done that if I hadn't been provoked into it. Or maybe I wouldn't have done this if I had stopped to think or whatnot. But after all, you do those things, and you might sometimes just as well face them. But anyhow, this time, my daughter had come and had joined our group. There wasn't any Alateen, and she was in college, but as I learned things in Al-Anon, just as when I had learned them in AA, I used to write them to her, and she became fascinated by the program and very, very impressed with it. So that in vacations, she always went with me, and she became a regular member of the group. Well, one time, she even told me, she said, Mommy, you know, you never really have taken the first step. And I thought, what kind of a monster am I raising, not taking the first step? Because I really had worked on it, but just not hard enough. This particular night, I had taken a full-time job then so that I would stop worrying about Jack and put my mind on my job. And things were tough at home this particular night, and I was on my way to a liquor store, and somebody had visited our group the week before and had said that her husband had been having a lot of difficulty, and he was having a hangover and was in bed. And while he was asleep, she went out and she got 3 quarts of liquor and she lined them up in a row where his eye would light on them the first thing when he woke up. And he did wake up and he flew out of that bed into the telephone. He'd say, please send somebody to help me. My wife is trying to make an alcoholic of me. And so I was on my way to the liquor store. I wasn't going to buy 3 bottles. I was going to have 6 there. And fortunately, just as I came to the corner of 52nd and Lexington, the light changed, and it was red. And I don't know whether the interval is 20 seconds, 15 seconds. I don't know. It's a short one anyhow, those cross streets. But as I stood there waiting for it, I just out of nowhere, it seemed to me that I actually heard the words, "Margaret, when are you going to take that first step?" And you know, suddenly it was just as if something had been lifted away. And I thought, by Jiminy, you never have taken it. They, all of them, were right. You still are trying to run Jack's life for him. And you haven't got so much in your own to be proud of. Look at the turmoil that you've made. Look at the burden that you've added. And with that, I think I really did take the first step. I turned on my heel, I went over to the subway, I went home, and from that day to this, I don't think it's a thing that you ever take really once and for all. I think you have to keep thinking of it. I think you have to keep reminding yourself that the most important thing that you can do is to let God take care of the alcoholic. You ask him to take care of you, and why shouldn't you trust the alcoholic with him? Well, it's not necessary for everybody to have the struggle with that first step that I had. There was one girl in our group, she'd only been to 3 meetings, I believe, and she came this night with a problem. She had 2 sisters in widely scattered parts of the country. I think New York, New Orleans, and somewhere out west. And the 3 of them had 1 week where they could meet each other for the first time in a couple of years in St. Louis, which was sort of central for all of them. And her problem was that her husband was drinking. She'd come home that night and found him drinking. And should she go and leave him? Well, of course, nobody in Al-Anon gives any marital advice. They tell their own experience if you ask them. But each one knows her own situation or his own situation, so that you can't give advice on a thing like that. But anyhow, she went right around the group and asked each person what he or she thought. And I had decided that I had been talking too much at meetings, so that night I didn't say anything. And so finally she came, she said, "Margaret, what do you think?" And I was knitting, which I thought might help me to keep quiet. And so I looked up at her and I said, "Well, he's drinking now, isn't he?" And you know, with that, she suddenly saw what the first step meant. That she was there now and he was drinking. What difference did it make whether she was in St. Louis? And she took that first step all those years ago. It's more than 15. And she has never deviated. I would say she is among the most fortunate. Because when I think of the hell that I made, not only for Jack, but for myself, I would hope that other people would never have such a struggle. There's one thing that we do believe in Al-Anon, and that is that the obligation is always forward. From the day I heard that little blue-eyed Irish girl tell about her curtains, I have never run into her in all of the thousands of meetings that I've attended. I never can tell her, unless she has read it somewhere in the forum, my very deep obligation to her. I believe she really and truly saved my sanity. I think Lois began it with her mean-spirited man. I think this little girl carried it further. And of course, Al-Anon, with its meetings and its people and its literature, did the rest. The only way that I ever can make even a token payment on my gratitude to Al-Anon is in the hope that some of my dumbness, if I'm honest enough to tell it, if I can forget that somebody might think, well, why listen to her? She's nuts still. If something that I say keeps somebody else even a month from the burden that I carried for so many years, it would be worth it. And it would help pay that little girl who helped me so much. It would help pay my debt to Lois, which I know never can be paid. But I think each one of us, if we have been helped by any part of this program, has a direct obligation to pass that help on to somebody who still needs it. And of course, with me, am I talking too long? I have looked Lois in the eye 1,000 times, and I say, Lois, I know you're 100 times more important to Al-Anon than I am. You have done more for more people than I'll ever do if I live to be 2,000 years old. But I wouldn't change places because I love the one I've got. And that is editing the forum. It's the most fascinating job in the world. I wish everybody here could see a day's mail, because it's wonderful. These people write, and you'd think we were old schoolmates. And we practically are, really, because we've all been to the same school. You aren't an Al-Anon really for fun. You're there because you've had an experience of living with an alcoholic problem. And editing the forum and reading how people have met their problems is the most fascinating thing in the world. When I began, I think we used to send out 200 a month. And I think maybe there were overs if we ran off 200. In September, 14,000 went out. And that's an awful lot of Al-Anon experience gathered in 12 pages, because it comes from all over the world. If anybody here has had an experience which has helped him or her, I would be terribly grateful. And I honestly think that it really is your obligation to write it to the forum. Because one way or another, what happens to you now happens to somebody else in Al-Anon sooner or later. What happens to one group now happens to another maybe in 6 months from now. And if they have read about it in the forum, they know how to get out of it quicker. And it's really a marvelous feeling to think that some dumbness on your part has led you, if you've overcome it, to help another person. so that I, who am probably the dumbest person in the world, am very grateful to be here today and to tell you I can't change what I have done. If I had had Al-Anon before any of it happened, I probably would have been different. But right now, I'm not sorry, because I have had all these tremendous years of Al-Anon. I have friends all over the world through the forum and through meetings like this, and I am terribly grateful. Thank you for inviting me.